Hello, this is Kevin Barrett. I hate banks, but I need money to survive and keep doing this show. So please go to truthjihad.com and subscribe.
Well, I hate banks and just can't stand them. Give me a shovel and man, I plan them. 6 feet under, that's where they belong. I hate banks is the name of the song. Think I robbed myself one or two. I hate banks, yeah, how about you? Well, lend me a nickel and lend me a dime. People says my house ain't on time. Financial institution think they're so highfalutin. Just a bunch of fruits in a three-piece suit, yeah. Trying to steal all my loot. Ooh.
Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio, the indispensable source for all info activists. And today we're going to talk with somebody who is, I think, as important as any info activist in the world. That would be Ellen Brown. She is a leading, shall we say, crusader? No, that's a taboo word here at Truth Jihad Radio. Let's call her a leading all-out struggler for transparency and honesty in the currency system. And this might be sort of the mother of all issues because it's the corruption in the financial system that enables all of the other crimes and conspiracies that we talk about here at Truth Jihad Radio, busting the Fed, going after the Bank of International Settlements, maybe even taking down the Rothschilds and the other big international banking families, and instituting a transparent global currency system will solve a lot of the problems that we talk about here. And Ellen is doing as much as anybody on earth to help enlighten people about the real structure of our incredibly corrupt financial system and how we can fix it. So she's got a new piece out on the Dodd-Frank bill, which was supposed to end the bankster bailout of 2008. This was passed in 2010, and it's not ending the bankster bailout. It's institutionalizing the bankster bailout and killing the small independent banks and credit unions. It's a scandal, and well, let's hear about it. Welcome, Ellen. How are you?
Thanks, Kevin. That's a great buildup. But you're right that the whole money system is very corrupt and very complicated. And that's why it's so interesting. I keep, you know, peeling back these onion layers. And you're always saying, no kidding, that's the way it works. It's shocking.
Yeah, it's a whole language. You know, money is really just a language, as you know. There's no inherent value in money. It's just a mathematical language to carry out trade. But it's a language that seems to have been taken over by liars. It disguises the real power, and it benefits the most powerful liars. I mean, it's quite shocking when you start looking at the details.
Mm-hmm. And it's a parasitic system. Under the Constitution, Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof. I mean, at that time, coins were the only officially recognized money supply. In other words, it was supposed to be the federal government that was issuing the money. And today, the federal government issues about $50 billion in coins, and all of the rest, $12 trillion or so in M2 circulating money supply, is issued by banks, private banks, when they make loans. So they do it by when they issue you a loan, they just write the money into your deposit account. I mean, they don't really have it. They just write it in there. And then they expect to cover it by pulling in deposits from somewhere else. But they also pay their bills that way. They just write the payment into the deposit account of the payee. It's,
last time I tried that, it didn't work for me.
I know. It's check cutting.
Yeah. It's an institutionalized counterfeiting system. So the remedy is basically to make it public, right? Public and transparent.
Yeah, exactly. Return it to the people. But if we can't do that, I mean, if we can't get the Federal Reserve to be nationalized, or we can't get Congress to see the light and start issuing U.S. notes like Abraham Lincoln did. He actually issued 40% of the money supply at one point as U.S. notes, and it was, so that would have been like $5 trillion today. And it did not create runaway inflation like everybody thinks it would. It actually worked. But if we can't do that, I'm chairman of the Public Banking Institute, so our thing is that if every state has its own bank, publicly owned bank, like in North Dakota, we can at least return the credit power to the people. Banks now create all of our money in the form of credit, so return that power to the people through banks. I mean, some people think we should get rid of the power of banks to create money, but I think that is actually a good thing. The whole banking system that has been created has funded, you know, U.S. the development of countries around the world. It's just a sort of credit and debit mechanism where you really fund your own, or you really monetize your own credit. You just go to the bank and write them an IOU and they give you money for it. So, and then they charge you some interest, you know, for taking the risk that you won't pay it back. So that all is a good system. You yourself are really creating the money. But the bad part is that it's privately owned and controlled. They can give us loans or not. Even creditworthy borrowers, they can deny, as they are now with small and medium-sized businesses are having trouble getting loans, because that's just not very interesting to the few big banks that are now running the country. And the small banks are being forced out, and they're being forced out largely by these Dodd-Frank regulations. They made it through the 2008 crisis. The big banks were the ones that got in trouble. The small banks were fine. And then what's killing the small banks is the regulations that were supposed to fix the crisis. Well, it's fixed it for the big banks. It's made them so they are permanently too big to fail. Like, they will not fail. If they look like they're going to fail, then they take our money in bail-ins. That's actually part of Dodd-Frank, that they're to take their creditors' money if they get in trouble.
Wow. You can't make this stuff up. So it sounds like the regulations here are being used to create a barrier to competition, which seems to be a common theme. You know, some of my libertarian friends have really stressed this, saying that those of us who favor a certain amount of government regulation of big money are wrong, because regulations are always written by Congress critters who are owned, bought, and paid for by the big money interests. So naturally, the kinds of regulations that they will create will be designed to favor those big money interests, typically by setting up barriers to entry into the field and helping perpetuate de facto monopolies. And whether or not that's always true, it looks like it may be true here.
Yeah, and they make it so complicated that you have to rely on somebody. I mean, who can read thousands of pages of legislation? And so they let the lobbyists write it, and the lobbyists then modify it. So the lobbyists basically are drafting the whole thing. And you have to wonder, I mean, some of these legislators at least look like they're honest and well-meaning, but they
which ones?
one or two, but they probably don't know what they're signing, or, you know, just don't. They've been misled like everyone else. I've really gotten into these, I don't know if I should get into this, but the hearings last week that were such a...
Tell us about those hearings.
Well, a triumph for Hillary. But they didn't ask at all, what are we doing in Libya in the first place? And everybody thinks that Gaddafi was a horrible dictator and a terrorist and so forth. That's not the way I read it. I mean, if they have such a sophisticated, spy network, intelligence network, why don't they know what we know about the amazing funding mechanism that Gaddafi had developed? I mean, first of all, he nationalized the oil and used the oil profits for the benefit of the people. They had a more democratic system than we did, where you actually voted at the local level on local issues. He gave, what is it, $500 per person, I think, when he was still in good shape. They gave $50,000 to young couples when they get married. They have free education, free health care. They own the central bank, and the central bank funded things. I mean, that's the way it should be. Plus, they were interest-free loans. It was, usury-free, REBA-free. So he actually did quite amazing things. And those waterworks, what was it called, the Great Libyan African
great
waterworks,
river or whatever it was, yeah,
were phenomenal, and that was all funded with just government issued money. So
and now, of course, yeah, we overthrew,
destroyed them. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. It's typically, you know, the U.S. overthrows leaders of foreign countries, not for their bad deeds, as we're told, but for their good deeds. You know, we see this over and over and over. You know, we overthrew Mossadegh in Iran for being honest and wanting to have Iran in control of Iran's oil. You know, we overthrew Allende for being a kind and gentle democratic socialist, not one of those communist gangsters. You know, we wanted to overthrow Fidel Castro, not because he abused human rights and kept political prisoners, because all of our allies did that even worse than he did, but because he was actually spreading the wealth around and having relatively honest governance. We overthrew Saddam Hussein, not because he was one of the most evil, brutal, fascist, dictatorial tyrants in world history, which he was. He tortured people in horrendous ways. No, that was all fine with us, because our stooges do that all the time. We overthrew Saddam Hussein because he was using the oil money for the benefit of the Iraqi people, building infrastructure, education, and so on. And likewise with Gaddafi. Gaddafi wasn't perfect. He had his downside. He was a human rights abuser, but that's not why we overthrew him and put something much worse in his place. It was actually these good things he did that led to him being overthrown, because any country's leadership that actually has the interests of their own people at heart is a threat to this petrodollar empire.
Mm-hmm. And probably the worst thing he did was he was trying to mobilize all of Africa to have their own money system, have an African monetary fund that would compete with the IMF. I mean, China's doing the same thing. I mean, the BRICS are doing the same thing now, but nobody can overthrow the BRICS. They're too big. But Libya could be gotten, and it was gotten.
Yeah, well, Libya was chipped off and taken care of, and then they were moving on to Syria. But Putin seems to have drawn the line in the sand there and says no more regime change. So it's kind of a standoff at the OK Corral over in Syria. How do you think that's going to end?
Well, I hate to find myself always rooting for the other team.
Yeah, I get tired of that too. Why can't we ever be the good guys?
Right. But it's great that somebody finally stepped up and said no more.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, I think this unipolar moment has gone on way too long. I mean, it should have been just a moment, like, you know, about 3 seconds. But, you know, Paul Wolfowitz and his PNAC people wanted to prolong it for 100 years. I don't think they're going to quite make that target, even with their little 9/11 stunt. so the world is still cursed to be interesting. Getting back to the finance issue, and this, you know, bankster bailout thing, it looks like it from your article, you know, I didn't realize it was this bad, that the smaller banks and credit unions have been going out of business at an accelerating rate. And, you know, we've been on the radio before talking about how this is an answer. People should be taking their money out of the big banks and putting it into the credit unions and the smaller banks, and that ultimately this process could save the day for us. But it looks like things are moving in the opposite direction.
Yeah, and intentionally moving in the opposite direction. The reason I wrote that article was, I was traveling and did 4 different conferences over the course of 5 weeks, and one of them was in New Hampshire. But we went and talked to the head of the local banking organization, and he was so upset. He was really angry at all the legislation, said that it was just driving them bankrupt and it was intentionally doing it. And there was no way that they could meet these requirements and they were all going to go out of business. So it was the other side. You know, you think that the regulations are supposed to be there to rein in the big banks and help the local banks, but they're not. They're really killing the local banks.
One of the scary statistics in your article is that the 6 largest U.S. financial institutions now have more than $10 trillion in assets, which is more than it's more than half. It's almost 60% of our GDP run totally, you know, owned by the 6 biggest institutions, probably with plenty of overlapping ownership and directorates. Tiny handful of people pretty much own the whole show.
Yeah, it is alarming. And how do we get out of it is another question. But it seems to me that then there will be another collapse. Many people are predicting it. And so the point of even talking about alternatives and getting them out there and getting people aware of alternatives is that when it does happen, then you know hopefully there won't be any more bailouts. I mean, we can't afford another bailout if it's a really big derivatives bank that goes down. So hopefully people will then look around and say, well, what about that public banking idea? We should try that. I mean, otherwise it does seem a little hopeless if you really say, how long have you been at this and how much progress have you made? But the progress is in educating people. Whenever you look historically at populist movements, they've always had a period first where the people meet, you know, they have picnics. And well, in the 1890s, I wrote quite a bit about that. The populist movement of the 1890s was also about money reform. And Wall Street was also the big enemy then. It was, you know, things haven't changed much in 100 years. But anyway, they all got together and they studied about how banking worked and what the problem was. And they were really more educated on the issues than people are today. Because the big banks have managed to buy out the big media and the educational system, it's very hard to break through that conditioning. My best editor on Web of Debt, my good friend, you know, we would read along and be editing and moving things around and just enjoying this process of creating something. And, you know, every hour or so, every so often, she'd scratch her head and she'd say, now, are you sure that's the way it really works? Because it was just so mind-boggling that banks actually create the money they lend. They are not intermediaries, as they purport to be. They do not take in deposits and lend them out. And they create our whole money system, not the government, except for coins, which are a bit minuscule these days. Which seems to me would be a good solution to the debt ceiling crisis, is issue some big coins. A few trillion-dollar coins would fix the problem, and it would not be hyperinflationary. It would just be like what Lincoln did in the Civil War.
Yeah, I've seen that idea debated even in the mainstream, and they don't really give a good reason why it shouldn't be done. It just seems like it's not politically possible because it would... You know, I suppose, but it's not in the interests of the big powers that run things now. You know, getting to the background here historically and philosophically, you know, your outlook basically makes really good sense to me, as, you know, in this particular time frame, the short term and medium term, you know, where we are now. But where we are now is kind of a strange anomaly in terms of the broader sweep of history. We are living in a culture that is used to extremely rapid growth, massively, you know, just insane, off the charts, exponential economic growth, and with it, population growth, growth and consumption of resources. And this has been going on now for a few centuries, and it's been getting, you know, more and more intense all the time. And the economy has had to grow with it. And some would argue that the cause and effect is actually the opposite. It's the economic invention of modern credit that actually fueled the growth. Before the modern era, you didn't have enough credit to create this virtuous cycle of, you know, somebody getting the money to do their entrepreneurial thing, and then money coming into the hands of customers, and so on and so forth. There was such a limit on credit that things couldn't grow really fast. So this new economy with the modern credit system starts developing 500 years ago, maybe a little less actually, and fuels this incredible growth-based world that we're in today. And so it seems normal and natural that credit would be just created magically at the flick of a pen, which is a process that, as you say, is not necessarily inflationary if there's actual growth. But my question is, how long can we be in a world of exponential growth? I don't see how it can last all that much longer given resource limits. And even human nature, I think, is ill-suited to a lot of this bizarre world that we've created out of runaway economic growth. So in the long term, I'm not sure that something more like the old system of if you don't have it, you can't lend it. A much tighter credit system might not be better, because, you know, once we get into a steady state growth world or even a permanent negative growth world, which is what we're likely to enter before too long, it just seems to me that we're not going to need that kind of massive credit anymore. Instead, we're going to have to figure out how to batten down the hatches and get used to a world of negative growth.
Well, funny you raise that. That is not actually how the credit system works. I mean, what you're doing is taking out an overdraft on your own account, and then you pay it back. But the thing is, you need to advance the credit first in order to do all those things we need to do. We definitely need infrastructure. California needs $700 billion worth of infrastructure, which we don't have the money. I mean, all that stuff actually can be, you know, in the long run, it'll actually save you money. If you fix your infrastructure, you can be more efficient. There are many things you can develop that save you money, you know, more efficient energy systems, et cetera. But you've got to direct your credit into those things. And that's the catch, it seems to me. In Benjamin Franklin's, you know, Colonial Pennsylvania, when he went to Pennsylvania or to Philadelphia and said there were all these signs up where places were boarded up. There was just not much happening. And the reason was there was no money. They didn't have banks at all. If they did, it was the Bank of England, and you had to pay quite high interest rates, and they didn't have their own money system. So the other colonies were just issuing the money directly, but it was easier to put it out there than to bring it back in the form of taxes. So they did tend to issue too much and to inflate the money supply and therefore devalue or, you know, raise prices. But in Pennsylvania, they did it as a bank. So they owned, it was called a land bank, supposedly backed by land, and they made loans to the farmers. So they created the money, printed all this money, lent it to the farmers, and the farmers paid it back. And then it was at 5% interest versus the 8% interest that the that the Bank of England was charging. So that it was a better deal for the farmers, and all of a sudden they had all this access to credit. So then they would, you know, produce things and pay it back, and plus interest. But the interest was out there because the government, which had the power to create money, could create that extra money and spend it. So let's say you started with $105, you could lend $100 at 5% interest, spend the $5. So you print $105, lend the $100 at 5% interest, spend the $5 on regular government things, roads and bridges and stuff. And then you've got $105 out there that can all come back to pay principal and interest. So you don't need to grow. You don't need to continually be expanding this money supply. The same money will do it. But the catch is right now you have it privately owned. The private controllers of this money spigot are not directing it into those infrastructure things that we need, or the, you know, local business, the people that hire people. They're directing it into derivatives, and they're buying up assets and loading them on ships, you know, and waiting to manipulate the market and so forth. They own a lot of things, ports and big things they own, with this ability to create credit, because they control the money spigot. So that control should go back to the government, and it should be regulated so that it goes where the economy needs it. And that's what they do in North Dakota. The Bank of North Dakota has certain mandates. In North Dakota, the things they're trying to support are agriculture, energy, and education particularly. So they give like 1% loans to startup farmers. They also give 1% loans to startup businesses. They have probably the best education lending system in the country. I saw they built a school last December, and they did a 1% loan for that. So they give low interest loans for particular projects that they want to develop or support. And that's the way they've done in other countries, like China. China would have, they create the money, of course, through their own banks. 80% of banks in China are either publicly owned or majority publicly owned and controlled. and they would direct the credit where they want to develop things. People talk about these empty apartments, but that's sort of the, or these empty buildings, but first of all, a lot of that is foreign investment, and the foreign investors are just, it's kind of like selling people land in Arizona, you know, you don't know what you're getting, you think it's a good deal to invest in. And partly, it's the Roosevelt, or the, sorry, the Keynes model that you can, you could bury money in the ground and have people dig it up, and you would still stimulate the economy because you would give them jobs. And they have a big population. Those buildings might get filled yet. I mean, I don't say the Chinese economy is perfect at all, but they certainly have gotten a lot of development done. And if they manage to get control of things like smog, then, I mean, we've done it in Los Angeles. The smog is a lot better than it used to be, or a lot, you know, there's a lot less smog than there used to be.
That's true. Yeah. I lived in the Los Angeles area when I was a kid in the late 1960s, and it was much worse then than it is now. So yeah, that's been an improvement. Well, speaking of China, what happened there? I think it was in August that China was a devaluing its currency, and then suddenly there were these warehouse explosions, you know, one of which left a crater that created a lake. It looked more like a mini nuke or something. Was there some kind of confrontation going on there, or was that just a coincidence?
I did read that too, and of course I'm a writer, so I love a good conspiracy theory.
Don't we all?
And what's happening in California? I mean, we have no rain. We've had virtually no rain for 4 years, and if you watch these weather patterns, there's this wall that's just keeps the storms from coming in from the Pacific Ocean. Why are the chemtrails are so heavy? It's just hard to believe that people don't look up and see that there's something very strange going on in the skies. They're all crisscrossed, not in a normal way. And they start and stop. You know, if it was really a normal contrail, it would be a consistent line. But they have them where they go for a while and they stop. And you can watch the plane. You know, it goes and there's the trail and then it stops and then it starts in again. And they have this weird way of spreading all over the sky so that suddenly, after a while, they look sort of like normal clouds. I mean, they've got this technique down. But who are they? What are they doing? And why can they do all that without telling us? I mean, we're the ones breathing that air. Why do we not know what's going on in our own environment?
Well, you know, Preston James was on my show the other night saying that it's actually like something like 10-foot tall human-eating lizards from outer space with 1,000-plus IQs who are doing the chemtrails. And I, so that's the extreme version. But frankly, you know, I don't know what's going on, but like you, I sort of wonder about how there's so little curiosity about it. And you know, you get invitations to a lot of relatively sort of mainstream, you know, left activist kinds of places. Like, you know, you were the star at this event in Madison, Wisconsin, sponsored by all the usual progressive suspects not too long ago. And so you have contact with these kinds of, what should we call them, the foundation-funded left and people like that. And those people won't touch any of these so-called conspiracy theories with a 10-foot pole. And yet, why won't they just look up? Do you ever mention this to them? Say, hey, look up in the sky, right? Does this look right to you? Do they talk about this in private but not in public? Or, you know, what's with these people?
Well, I don't know that I've talked about chemtrails to political activists, but I've certainly, there are other things, like even the whole banking issue. Why are the people on the left not really interested? You would think it would be the people that have really taken up the money reform issue are the people on the right, like the Tea Partiers, and they want to just get rid of the Fed and go back to gold and things that I think are not workable. But for some reason, people on the left think either it's unimportant or... Anyway, that's another reason that I just keep writing to get ideas out there. They're in other countries, they seem to be more receptive than in this country. Of course, you can understand why, because they have a history of public banks more than we do.
Yeah, but we have a history of political struggle over this very issue, starting with the American Revolution, the struggle between the banksters and the not-so-banksters during the 19th century, culminating in the Federal Reserve. I mean, this is very much part of our U.S. history.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's kind of been taken off the table starting with the early 20th century.
Mm-hmm. Could be arguably just that because we were the dominant economy for so long, we're the ones that have been muzzled and that they've really focused on, buying up the media and twisting the way things are. I don't know. It's odd. I mean, I like Bernie Sanders very much, but he doesn't seem to really get into the hot issues either. So, I mean, Donald Trump might be our only hope there because he's not a politician, so they can't blame it on him. He didn't do it. I mean, I think that's one reason they didn't talk at these hearings about why were we in Libya in the first place, because it was a bipartisan thing. They'd be implicating themselves, but an outsider can come in and point up all the things that are wrong. And
yeah, do you think Trump actually has a chance of winning? And you know, can you imagine what a Trump presidency would be like if he did?
Well, it'd be interesting. We live in interesting times.
Yeah, I mean, is there evidence that he has any kind of interest in this kind of reform, or is he kind of just providing entertainment by, you know, voicing a few truths that you're not supposed to voice? This 9/11 thing he's gotten into with Jeb Bush is certainly interesting.
Well, and he's against the TPP. He's against the big banks. He's for healthcare for all. He's against forced vaccinations. I mean, he's really a populist. He's really more on the left. I saw that somewhere that Hillary was really on the right and he was really on the left.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what's happened in France. There's a book out called Who is Charlie? By a leading French sociologist, Emmanuel Todd. And it's the second best book on the Charlie Hebdo thing from last January, my own book being the best, which is We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, Freethinkers Question the French 9/11, which gets into the false flag aspect of it. But Todd, in his book, Who is Charlie?, just, you know, ignores that and looks at what this says about the political system in France, that they were able to get 5 million, well, maybe 4+ million, possibly up to 5 million people marching like lemmings in the streets with identical I Am Charlie signs in the same font. And, you know, just a complete mass mind control operation. Who are these people who got out in the streets and they were interviewed, and the people in the streets in these crowds didn't have the faintest idea they were there, why they were there. It was almost like, you know, how Sirhan Sirhan, after the Bobby Kennedy assassination, had no idea why he had supposedly shot Kennedy, had no bad feelings about Kennedy, totally oblivious because he'd been under hypnotic control. And likewise, these 4+ million people marching in the streets of France did not have any coherent explanations of why they were out there. They made a few emotional grunts, but they couldn't explain it. And so Emmanuel Todd does a sort of a psychoanalysis of the French political consciousness and finds that everything's kind of gotten turned upside down in France. France used to be based, since the French Revolution, it's been based on a split between the left-wing kind of progressive secularists who have been the dominant force, and they live in certain geographical areas like Paris. And then the other party in France is the Catholic, you know, royalist types, the traditionalists, and they've been the minority party since the French Revolution, with a few ups and downs. But so traditionally, socialists and communists, who are kind of socialist, should be representing this sort of secularist socialist group and fighting for equality, you know, liberté, égalité, fraternité, right? That's the French Revolutionary slogan. So the socialists should be representing that. And then the conservative opposition should be representing the Catholic kind of traditionalist group. But everything's been turned upside down. And Mitterrand, the socialist leader, was actually running a CIA counter-coup, basically. The CIA was alarmed by the Communist Party in France during the Cold War, so they created the French Socialist Party as a kind of a false flag party, and it took power, and it's become actually the site of the Catholic royalist conservative side of France. Like, all of the districts in France that are associated with this Catholic kind of traditionalist side have been the main mainstay of support of the Neo-Socialist Party. And the conservative parties are now getting the support from the other side, from, you know, the secularist socialists. So it's been turned upside down. The former left wing is now the right wing. The right wing is now the left wing. They're called the zombie Catholics, according to Emmanuel Todd. And likewise, in the U.S., I think there's something a little bit like that going on, where, you know, the political forces have sort of been hijacked and flipped, and they don't really mean that much anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's always been that way, that they pitted the two parties against each other. You know, you're supposed to join one of these two sides, and then you're supposed to be opposed to the other side. And then in that way, they avoid the real issues. I mean, you wind up voting for your party instead of voting for the people. I saw a really good video about the Chinese system, and it was by a Chinese who said he thought that although they are technically not, I mean, there's only one party, he thought that was actually a better system, because the young people who get out of college and then they join the Communist Party, I think half of them join the Communist Party, and then they work their way up. So they've got 40 years in government before they ever hit the top, and then they're selected on the basis of how well they perform. So they've got all this experience in directing larger and larger groups of people and larger economic issues and, you know, banking and money issues. And who we elect are usually like the wives of rich people or movie stars or, you know, whatever, famous people of one sort or another, people who can get the funding to get in there, but they don't necessarily have the qualification, or in fact, they quite often don't have the qualifications to do legislation. And that's the scary thing, that they're dealing with these very complicated bills, like the Dodd-Frank bill, very long. There should be a rule that no bill that you have to pass tomorrow should be more than whatever, 15 pages or something that you can read in one evening and digest it.
Right. Well, mentioning how the Chinese system works, that's actually not that different from the way the Chinese Empire has functioned for thousands of years, with their imperial bureaucracy that selects for competence and promotes people. And there's an upside to that, which is general competence, but there's probably a downside too, which is perhaps there can be hidebound mentalities that get sort of fossilized and institutionalized. You can't really see somebody like Trump coming in and shaking things up in the Chinese power structure, although they've had a few shakeups. But yeah, I think there are advantages and disadvantages to the different models. But this one, I think the Western capitalist bankster-driven model seems like it's reaching its culminating point where it's going to implode. And, you know, we're all waiting for that moment when somehow the financial house of cards comes down. There's so much debt, as you point out in your many works, that it's really unsustainable over the long haul. So the question that is on a lot of people's minds is, how long will they draw this out? Will there be a massive collapse overnight at some point? How soon will that be? Or will they be able to kind of keep muddling along in this sort of post-2008 world for decades?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good question. We all keep watching and waiting for something big to happen, but they seem to be able to manipulate it around. And one really interesting model that is in Ecuador now, where they, getting back to the money issues, where the Ecuadorians are using the dollar as their official currency. So what they've had to do is take boatloads of printed dollars printed in the U.S., and that's what they use for money. So now the central bank has set up the system where they're using digital dollars, and they say a dollar is a dollar. A digital dollar is going to be the same as a regular dollar. I think they implemented it last January, and it's getting more and more popular. Everybody's doing it. And you can have an account at the central bank. So effectively what they're doing is issuing money. They say they're not, and they say they're not going to pay their budget with this digital money, that they're just supplementing for their lack of paper money. But in fact, that's you know, that's what they're doing, that in order to, because they don't have the reserves to supply all the dollars that they need, they're using credit card or digital bank card type exchanges. Everybody's got a cell phone these days, so they can do these cell phone exchanges. So I think that's actually what we're evolving toward, is a system where it's all one big banking system. We acknowledge that it's all just credit. It's just your own credit. It's the government running it. Of course, nobody trusts the government, but that's because we need to take back our government. If it's a government like Ecuador's, which really does seem to have the public interest at heart and has, you know, they've declared the rights of the earth, Bill of Rights for the Earth, that sort of thing. If it were a good government that were actually was actually operating for the benefit of the people, like in North Dakota, and you had one big central bank or just one big banking system, acknowledge that banking is just a public utility. It's a flow, just like water is a flow and electricity is a flow. You want to tap into the grid, so you also want to tap into the credit flow, the grid of the credit, the national credit system. So basically all you're doing is taking an advance against your own account when you take out a loan, and then you pay that back with the proceeds of whatever it was you built or did with the money. So
yeah.
Anyway, I just thought that was a unique model, and I'm keeping my eye on it because they're getting away with it. They're saying, you would think if they did that it would collapse, because you would have all the short sellers would come in, but they're saying no, a dollar's a dollar. We're not letting it be subject to the whims of the market here. You can't short sell this money. It's a dollar. It's just a digital dollar, and it's working.
Wow. Now I would think that this system might be vulnerable to the same problem that's plagued banking forever, which is when all the depositors want their deposits in cash or in gold or what have you, and they all line up at once, then the whole system becomes insolvent. Like the Ecuador government has got X amount of dollars, and then they're putting out these digital dollars, so-called, which are just computer marks, and people are running around using those with their smartphones. That's all well and good. But if one day enough people suddenly say, wait a minute, you know, we don't know how many digital dollars they're cranking out, you know, they're just making this stuff up, we would like real paper dollars, and they go line up at the government office to get their paper dollars, you know, with their cell phones, and here's my cell phone digits, I want paper dollars, then it would collapse, just like all of these kinds of credit schemes always have, you know, throughout history. They've been vulnerable to this kind of run on the bank scenario, which shows how the whole system is really a kind of religion in a sense, Ellen. It's based on faith, you know, that in a sense a religion is, you know, any sort of belief in an order that's, you know, bigger than what we see around us, bigger than the human natural human order. And credit, these systems of which we call it the creating of money out of thin air, or lending more out than you have, lending more tickets that say good for one little bit of silver than you have silver to back it up. Which is how the whole modern system started. You know, all of this requires a huge amount of faith. And it sort of, you know, this ties in with philosophical questions about, you know, what's real and what's not. You know, is it real just because we all have faith in it? And then what happens if somebody says, oh, the emperor has no clothes, and suddenly everybody's lined up in front of the bank looking for their money or their gold, or in this case, their U.S. dollars from Ecuador.
Mm-hmm. But really what it is, what our banking system is today, is one great big community currency system. They're pretending that they're lending money that they have, but they aren't. They're actually just writing you in advance against your own account. So that's what you do in a community currency system, where two people want to deal. You know, somebody wants, I say, I'll pay you 5 credits if you'll wash my car. And then now my account is, assume it's a digital community currency. My account now has a -5 and your account has a +5. And
it sounds like Philip K. Dick. His currency unit was pos creds for positive credits.
Yeah.
You owe me 5 pos creds. Yeah.
So you know, it, I don't see why you couldn't, if you had a run on the bank, say, well, we've run out of cash, you know, we have to get those from the U.S. and the boat didn't come or something, but not to worry, we'll just write you out this little a check, and it's perfectly good, you know, go and make it a, what do you call it, those checks that are like cash. You can spend it.
Cashier's check? I
don't know. Yeah, cashier's check. We'll just write you out a cashier's check for your money if you want to pull it out, and you can spend it anywhere in the country, perfectly good check. If people understood how banking worked, they wouldn't be so freaked out about those paper dollars that are really no different from digital currency.
Right. Well, so we should believe in it because it works, and it works because we believe in it.
Yeah, well, it's just an agreement, a system of mutual credit agreements between people, among people.
That sounds reasonable to me. But, you know, there is this issue of sort of faith, belief, and worldview that does come into this in all these different ways. You know, traditionally in Islam, for example, all forms of lending at interest were haram or absolutely forbidden. And indeed, piling up money is clearly forbidden or at least discouraged in Islam. There's even a very clear surah, the Surah At-Takathur, that says this. You're not supposed to pile up money. You're supposed to give it away in alms, and not just the 2.5% wealth tax per year in zakat, but also in other forms of charity. So in the traditional Islamic culture, which actually worked pretty well in a slow growth world, people finance enterprises mainly through real money in the sense of physical currency of various types that was actually owned and held, you know, and like people would have these treasure hoards and coins and stuff. And if your nephew or your neighbor wanted to start an enterprise and you had these coins, you would lend it without interest, or maybe even just gift it if you had more than you could use. So this was more of a world where it seems like there was a little more, call it altruism or a spirit of charity or what have you. And today's world, which is so mathematically exact, you know, every value of everything has been calculated down to the tiniest fraction, and we're keeping track of everything, and that's brought in a spirit of intense self-interest where everybody really has to pay close attention to every transaction, to their whole bank account. Whereas in the old world, up until the modern times, most goods and services were actually passed in the form of gifts. The market was a small fraction of them. Most things, you would just do something for your neighbor, your friend, or your family member, or one of the 100 or more extended family members that you knew about in your area. You just do it because you knew they'd take care of you when they needed to. And frankly, I miss that old world, Ellen. I mean, this world where we have to worry about our bank account, where so everything's in the market now, you know, all sorts of incredibly value-creating stuff is now gone because it's not in the market. You know, my mother, for example, you know, the most valuable thing either my mother or father ever did when I was a kid was my mother took care of us, stayed home, and made meals right up until I was 12. Then she went off to be an accountant, and we started eating complete garbage. We had to take turns making the meals. I used to make... I made some amazingly hideous meals, like peanut butter on taco shells was one of the good ones. They still remember these horrific things that I would serve up for the so-called family dinner. economic terms, the GDP blossomed because of this. My mom was off earning money as an accountant, and so the GDP went way up. We had a whole new accountant salary to add to the GDP. But the actual real good stuff in the world went way, way down because we lost by far the most valuable thing that anybody in my family was doing for other people in the real world. So my mom's off manipulating little marks on paper that are producing nothing whatsoever for anybody, for North Sales Company, which is making sales for sailboats for rich people. Who gives a crap? It was a gigantic loss, but it was a gain for the GDP, and there's so much of that that's gone on. And we've lost our communities, which is the one thing that happiness studies show that makes people happy, is being in a tight community, and the best community has a lot of people you're related to, you know, and interacting with those people all the time in a non-financial way is what makes people happy. That's all gone. We're atomized individuals now, bowling alone, staring at our screens, worrying about every penny that changes hands in this stupid marketplace that we're sucked into. It's Dante's seventh circle of hell or worse. So I don't have faith in economics of any kind, and ultimately not even yours, which is by far the best of all the kinds of economics I've seen, to make human life better. I think we need to maybe get out of economics to make human life better.
Well, or I think we need an economic bill of rights like Roosevelt proposed, where we would cover basic living requirements, because you feel like, well, I can't give it away because what if I get sick, you know, and what if my insurance doesn't cover it and I'll need that money, or what if one of my kids gets sick or something, so I better save it. And then people think they're saving when they invest it. They think, well, I'm not just hoarding it, I'm investing it, so I'm investing it in some good thing. But as you point out, all those growth things, where when you're investing it, you want your money back plus interest. So you want even more back than you put out there. So that's not the same as actually spending it. But in order for people to feel secure about giving it away and helping other people, they need to first have their basic requirements covered. And we could do that. We could do that just by printing the money, and it would not be inflationary. And I've written about this before.
That sounds like a good idea. Okay, I vote for that. So we've already, you know, we've talked about this kind of, you know, backsliding situation where we work for community currency and local banks, and this legislation that they passed supposedly to fix the bankster bailout is actually making it worse. If you're going to give people, like, you know, one thing to focus on to try to make things better in this area, what would it be?
Well, in that particular article, as in most of my articles, I pointed to the Bank of North Dakota model. We need state-owned banks that are able to nurture our local banks and our local credit communities. But, I mean, that's not exactly your religious Islamic result where people can give it all away. For that, we'd have to go back to smaller communities where we know each other and trust each other. And whether that will happen, I don't know. Cities look pretty much here to stay. I mean, if we had a big disaster, we're all just going down. We don't have gardens. We don't have a water, you know, our own well or something like that. We're reduced to city living, and we probably will be doing city living for a long time. So it seems to me the best we can do right now is to focus on city-owned banks, state-owned banks, some way in which we, the people, regain control of our money system.
And we can. Are there states right now where we're seeing progress towards new state banks?
Yeah, actually, there is progress. We're at the point where, for the Public Banking Institute, we need to come up with a team of experts that actually know how to design legislation, know how to do a business plan, that sort of thing, that's actually persuasive to legislators. So as usual, we're short of funding, but we're working with, there's one city in New Jersey where the finance officer, finance administrator, was a banker for 35 years. And so we presented this idea to him, and he totally got it because he understood banking. He said, I could have that bank up and running and successful, you know, profitable in a few months. So we're working with him and the mayor there, and we just need to come up with, we're at the point where we've got to start drafting these official documents, which I have to admit to not being capable of, even though I'm a lawyer, but I'm not I'm not trained in that particular kind of legislative attorney law.
Okay, well, it sounds good to me, and you know, I could keep talking to you. I have more questions I could ask about, you know, cryptocurrencies, as they have a role to play, and on and on and on. There's so much to talk about in this area because it's so central and so important, but we've hit the end of the hour. So thank you, Ellen Brown. You have the website ellenbrown.com, and anywhere else you want to send the listeners?
The publicbankinginstitute.org for more information on approaching your local legislators, how to set up a bank, why it's a good idea, what's been done before, etc. So it's great talking to you.
Yeah, likewise. I appreciate your uncommon insights and this really cutting edge info activism you're doing. So keep up the great work.
Okay, you too, Kevin.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Yeah, throw the money changers out of the temple. I hate banks, it's just that simple. Royal crown, pomade ten is a best thing to keep your money in. Yeah, mason jar is okay too if you see
your bank, well, you know what to do. Now, let me tell you people something. Only banks I like Ernie Banks, all right. And I like the banks of the Mississippi River. Yeah, and I like banks of Fender Twin Reverb, electric guitar amplifiers behind me, raging on the staging, yeah. Well, when I walk in there dreaming like a dog, wanna hit him in the head with the doo-doo log. Republicans, one and all, their tallywhackers are mighty small. Steal from the poor and to give to the rich. Wanna make the bank president twitch in a ditch. Oh, how, how? Yeah, see that teller with the blue hair giving me the evil eye stare. Won't cash my check, don't like my ID. Got the security guard after me, huh? If I was P.F. Sloan, I'd say the Dow Jones can suck my bone, yeah. All right, everybody say these three magic words. I want you to help me say the words. I want you to repeat after me. Here we go. I hate banks. Yeah. I hate banks. Can't stand them. I hate banks. Don't like them. I hate banks. Bunch of foo-foos.
I hate banks.
Up there like a big zit.
I hate banks.
Wow. I hate banks. Just can't stand them. Give me a shovel and man, I plant them. 6 feet under, that's where they belong. Yeah, how about you? Ooh. Now let me tell you something else. I'm not real fond of the phone company either, you know. Yeah, and I don't like the cable TV company. You know why I don't like the cable TV company? Because they just be stuck in that stuff right out the sky. They don't have to pay nothing for it. And I just get me one of them bootleg cable boxes, and I get me one of them there, climb up the pole and stick the thing in. I ain't gonna pay for it. No!
Keep saving up all those pennies. You never know. Baby, it's not easy saving all your pennies. Even when it's not raining, your world is turning upside down. One day you hope to start all over again. Keep saving up to go bankrupt. You got no money, just something to say. The banks don't care to understand. No thanks, buddy, you did your best. You wake up from your American dream. Is broke, corrupt. You're saving up to go bankrupt. Wake up, wake up. You're saving up to go bankrupt. Wake up, wake up. Saving up to go bankrupt. Keep you saving up. You're looking for a future. Look it straight in the eye. You won't blink. Who's to think? You got no place to hide. You got no savings. Don't own a home. Hot air's blowing us all around. Now not everyone can join the band, but everyone can take a stand. Let's build tomorrow brick by brick. When the good luck comes, it's gonna stick. We may be down, but not for long. Come on! Wake up from your American dream. The real world ain't on a TV screen. The system's broke and it's corrupt. Saving up to go bankrupt. Wake up, wake up. You're saving up to go bankrupt. Wake up, you wake up. You're saving up to go bankrupt.
Keep saving those pennies.
Mountain everywhere. The cream doesn't always rise to the top. Sometimes it's crap, and sometimes it's rot. Ben Franklin was a cooler cat. A good conscience is where it's at. Keep saving up, and you'll go bankrupt.
wake up from your American dream. The real world ain't on a TV screen. System's broke, man, it's corrupt. You're saving up to go bankrupt. Wake up, wake up. You're saving up to go bankrupt. Wake up, come on, wake up. We're saving up to